And right now, we're not the only island nation of 5 million or so souls wondering just how we're going to meet the unprecedented economic challenges of COVID-19. This week, Ireland's government unveiled the biggest ever spending budget that the country's ever seen. It's been described as a desperate bid to boost economic growth and business and kickstart some of their shovel-ready projects while they're at it. So are there any lessons for us in what they're doing over there? Looking on critically is one former Irish banker who's now known as the Punk Economist, who also podcasts in a bid to simplify economics.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
Thanks so much for joining us on Sunday morning on RNZ National, David.
Not at all, Colin. It's absolutely my pleasure. My pleasure.
I gather you have got another set of lockdown restrictions coming in where you are. And just listening to the most recent edition of your podcast, you're talking to your colleague there, John Davis, about maybe having to hit the gym in order to, I think your words were, lose the bag, and that the bag had made a return.
Yes, the bag. Do Kiwis not well, the Kiwis will understand what the bag is. There comes a certain time in a man's life where he doesn't want to look like a mammal head to toe in overly tight lycra, okay?
Yeah.
But the fear, of course, is the bag. It's the Ned Kelly, as we call it, the belly, right? The bag is a Dublin expression for a middle-aged man's Ned. And, of course, what happens in the COVID is you become, if you weren't on first-name terms with the local off-license seller, you become absolutely his best mate. In fact, we've been going through rakes of Antipodean wine, New Zealand Pinot Noir. Yeah, we'll have four of them, and that's almost per night. So the combination of doing nothing, no gym, and the middle age spread means the bag is completely out of order, and we have to get to it. But the new COVID restrictions, which are what they call level three here, no gym for us alphalas. So the bag reigns supreme.
I'm grateful that you did answer my next question, which was John Davis comparing middle-aged men's Neds. And I was wondering whether I was going to have to ask and regret asking that question. But so
the,
Ned Kelly,
Ned
belly. So this is like
from,
Irish rhyming
the Ned
slang?
Comes from the this is what we've given the world, you know, Ned Kelly and all such other great contributors to the fiscal probity of the Aussies. Ned Kelly is the belly. You know, it's kind of Irish rhyming slang, yeah.
But look, right now, you've had, I think, an Irish budget just this week. I read some of the commentary of it, your finance minister releasing that and saying, you know, the biggest spending ever. And I guess there are a few countries in that boat. I mean, ours is one of them as well. We've had an election campaign that we've just gone through where, you know, eye-watering sums of money and the economic management of it. You have spoken about this being a huge opportunity because pretty much all fiscal restraints or previous restraints on budget spending have gone.
Yeah, look, I mean, Colin, I think that budgets should not be accounting identities, which are a sort of an annual P&L, and you talk about what you're going to do in 1 year. I think you should look further out, and you say, well, the problems in Ireland are, you know, COVID apart and that shock, that will pass. You know, there's little doubt it will pass. The question is, how long is it going to take? The major issue in Ireland, and the issue that's driving politics elementally as opposed to cosmetically, is the fact that young Irish people are being completely priced out of the housing market. In Ireland, we have this extraordinary situation where youth unemployment and youth migration from outside has been at unprecedented levels. The economy has an ability to create jobs in a way we never thought before. I'm talking about the last 5 or 6 years. But the kids have nowhere to live. They've nowhere to live. They can't afford anywhere. The rents are exorbitant, let alone punters trying to buy. And there's three or four issues here. One, I think, Colin, is social. Those really key milestones in your life, you know, moving out from your mum and dad, moving into your own flat, moving in with your mates, then maybe in with your girlfriend or your boyfriend. The process of growing up, maybe even getting married, maybe even having a kid. These sort of milestones that for my generation were all more or less achievable in our 20s. And by the time we were 30, we'd actually achieved most of those milestones. This is now not possible for the generation coming behind us. And the reason they can't, ground themselves. They can't find a place. So your 20s is an incredibly important decade, which we tend to be flippant about as we get older, but in actual fact, it's an incredibly important decade. So one of the jobs of a civilized state is to provide a situation where the private sector can build and rent houses at a decent rent for decent people earning decent wages. Then you begin an entire social, political, and economic revolution that happens right under your own noses.
Well, David, that has echoes here in New Zealand because while the economy is having a real COVID hit, the one thing that hasn't been affected is house prices. They're surging. Interest rates are low. Borrowing is easy. It's a real problem. And it came up in our election campaign, but our Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, saying she would actually quit rather than impose any kind of capital gains tax. You've argued that, I think you described it as front-loading the building of houses should have been the absolute centre of this Irish budget that you've had this week.
Absolutely.
But how would it work?
Well, it's very easy. I mean, you know, a state that can shut down an economy, okay, by an executive order, can rebuild an economy, okay? In the Irish context, we built state houses for many, many decades here. That was a fundamental pillar of our social policy, in the same way as free education, free health. These are sort of social democratic norms. Basic economics, the economics that people will learn in university and in Irish school in New Zealand, will say something like this, which is that when the price goes up, the demand goes down. Okay, and everyone says, oh, that sounds good. It's actually not true. In a free market with lots of credit in the housing market, when the price goes up, the demand goes up. And the reason is that those people you're talking about in the auction houses, when they see prices rising, they panic and they front load their buying. So the very act of increasing prices brings forward rather than retards demand. Okay, then you get panic buying. That panic buying, people try to elbow themselves out, each other out at the market, pushes up prices. That's the first thing. The second thing, if you leave it to the free market, is classical economics would say, well, you know, when the price rises, the supply will rise, and the supply will rise to meet the demand. That's actually not what happens at all. What actually happens is when prices rise, people who want to sell or people who are sitting on land or builders who have permits ready to go, they say, well, you know what, maybe we'll get in the Kiwi example, another $20,000 this time next year, or $30,000. So why don't we just wait? Because suppliers say, well, you know what, I'll make more money by releasing land next year. Then you get a panic. That's where the state has to come in. I'm not surprised that your prime minister, who's a member of the Labour Party, doesn't want to do what all left-wing politicians should do, which is bring in a wealth tax. And it's because you see it all over the world, the centre-left are paralysed by the sins of the past. Okay, so the centre-right are much more likely to actually execute a wealth tax. The reason the centre-left don't do it, it was the Tony Blair dilemma, it was the Bill Clinton dilemma, was that the centre-left have spent so much of their time trying to pretend that they're not from the left tradition, but they're from the centrist tradition, that it's impossible for them to go back to what would be old left ideas. This we know not to be the case when interest rates are zeros and we're faced with a pandemic. In fact, the most prudent thing to do now is to spend. Because you spend in a downturn, you reap the rewards, you generate the cyclical growth, your tax revenue comes in the upswing, and you pay back. This is basic economics that most macroeconomists would get. In the same way as in Ireland, housing in New Zealand is also the main vector for inequality. So what you do is you see people hoarding land, you see people who can't afford, they buy, they sit in it. And what you see is that the wealth inequality statistics for New Zealand and for Ireland, two quite similar economies actually, quite similar demographics and quite similar sizes, etc. Both of them see that the housing market is the main instrument of inequality. So consequently, income taxes will not affect that in any way. The only thing that will actually help that are wealth taxes.
I mean, electability is also the issue, right? And I don't know how it is in Ireland, where I think you have one of the youngest populations in Europe. But here in New Zealand, the sort of received wisdom is that there are hundreds of thousands of younger people that don't vote.
There's a great expression which the young and the old have one thing in common. They're bullied by the middle-aged. And I think that's quite a good expression, which is that So you see that it's the middle-aged that tend to form policies for themselves. In Ireland, the centre parties have looked after the middle-aged and the old for quite some time, and now you're seeing this backlash amongst the young. And I think these demographic cleavages in societies are something we're seeing all over the English-speaking world, where the young do feel left behind. Now what I see here in Ireland is young people in their 20s or even early 30s do not seem to have the same stake. But the interesting thing is then the economy was split in the society into insiders and outsiders. And the insiders are what you've just identified, the older population who have something, they have a stake, and they have what they hold, and they circle the wagons, and they vote in big numbers. The youngers are maybe the outsiders, and they do not have a stake, but eventually they do have a vote. And if they decide to vote, they will change the electoral process and the political dominoes in New Zealand, as is happening here. It's quite natural. I mean, the one thing we do know is whatever party has the young has the future.
Yeah, and one thing that I've heard you speak about is also education. So, because I guess this is something our young people have in common with yours, they're English speaking. They can travel, they're mobile, we have bigger neighbours with bigger job markets in normal times, of course, not in COVID times. So you've made the point that I think you waste a large part of the state investment you make in educating people under the age of 20, 25 if they just up sticks and leave because you've neglected their needs in order to get elected.
When I was younger as a kid, I worked in all the bars of Earl's Court with many New Zealanders. And every single educated person you lose is a massive cost. So a back of the envelope calculations, this will be queried by the Department of Education because the figure is so high, but it probably costs in most sophisticated countries between 500,000 and 600,000 or 700,000 euros to educate an individual from the very first year they go into primary school or elementary school, all the way through to the day they leave a primary degree, let's say a four-year university degree. So think about that in the context of a country like New Zealand. If you lose a substantial amount of your young people who go overseas, maybe for fun, for the crack, you know, they haven't been out of the country and it's you know, and you're a long way from the rest of the world, so you're not going to go for a few weeks, you know, you're going to go for a long time. But the cost to society of losing your educated people is phenomenally high. The converse is also the case. The benefit to your society from attracting in educated people is phenomenally high. So a country like Ireland over the last 10 years, in particular, maybe the last 5 years, has attracted in a huge amount of educated migrants from the rest of Europe. That is a massive one-off benefit to us. And it's a cost to the countries that have lost their educated young people. So, you know, there is a dynamic here, and the dynamic is very clear that the societies that can provide the best standard of living, access to the labour market, take-home pay, etc., for younger mobile people. If you think young Irish people and young New Zealanders are actually in the same labour market, in the same international labour market. And if we can provide opportunities for young Kiwis, they're going to come here and they're going to live here and they're going to live in Europe and only go home once or twice, maybe even once a year. That's a huge, huge, huge net gain to us and a huge loss to you. And I think that our government, thankfully, after having spent a lot of weeks guffawing about, you know, being fiscally prudent and whatever, has realized that the light is green and it's now time to actually move ahead and fix some of the infrastructural projects or problems that need to be fixed.
But although you say that, David, and of course we've heard that during our election campaign too, people, the opposition parties have been warning, look, unprecedented amounts of money being spent here, it's borrowed money, they are going to have to pay this back, right? So
You're still traumatized by euthanasia down there, you poor Kiwis. Okay, it's a long time. It's true though. You are, you know, the post Jim Bulger settlement in New Zealand, right? The idea of these bond vigilantes that are going to punish governments who overspend is frankly ludicrous. at a time when central banks have signaled that interest rates are going to remain low for a long time. Nothing to do with COVID, it's to do with the fact that basically the two or three big areas of savings, the two big areas of savings in the world are Japan and the European Union. We are getting older. And when I say we, I talk the Germans, the Italians, the French. They're getting older, as to the Japanese. The low interest rate environment is here to stay. In fact, fiscal policy and monetary policy are almost the same thing right now. You can spend your time catastrophizing about what might come 10 years hence, but the really cavalier attitude with respect to economics now is not spending when you should do. That, in my book, is far more reckless. And I speak as a former central banker, former investment banker. You know, I come from the orthodox side of the tribe. But what I see now is a one-off opportunity to fix some serious structural imbalances, infrastructural imbalances. And I think we should take these opportunities right now.
So broadly speaking, David, with one of the youngest populations in Europe, I think I'm right in saying that. I mean, is that,
yes,
in the current condition, is that actually an asset or is that a liability? I know it sounds horrible putting it like that, but if you're trying to restructure an economy for post-COVID times, absorb the hit and borrow the money and so on, does it make it harder? Or is it actually a great asset to have a young population?
I think a young population is always an asset. Always an asset. You know, when you look at countries that get old and become decrepit, what happens in countries that become older is countries stop spending, they start saving. It's called the lifestyle hypothesis in economics. It's the sort of thing you learn in first year in economics, that as you get older, the society becomes more fragile, much less tolerant, much more likely to be reactionary, much more likely to be unimpressive when it comes to startup companies. You look at young populations. Young populations give us energy. They give us dynamism. They give us new ideas. They give us startups. They give us culture. They give us music. Even if you look at the creative works of most great musicians, they're done in their 20s and 30s. They're not done when you're older. Great literature, great art, with the exception of Picasso, is largely done again in people's 20s or 30s. Joyce had written Ulysses by the time he was 40. You know, there is an effervescence in the youth, which is not just an economic effervescence. It's a physical, sexual, pheromonal effervescence. And that is what drives countries forward. Now, does it make countries slightly less stable? Yes, it does. But I would have thought, Colin, that the job of our generation, my generation, is to give to my kids a country that was a slightly better nick than the country that my mum and dad gave me. And I believe that's our challenge. And I think that's what economics should be all about. It should not be about balance sheet problems, accounting identities, numbers of GDP with respect to debt. It should be about much, much bigger issues. So rather than anchor economics around double entry bookkeeping and accountancy, what we should anchor economics is about deep, deep social trends, which are actually going to fundamentally change the country. And those, one of those major ones is demography. And a young population is a fantastic thing. And God knows most countries will be down on bended knee looking for young populations. You go to Italy, France, Germany, the populations are getting older quickly. The economies are beginning to slow down. The societies are delivering extreme right-wing politicians in the case of France and Italy. I would say, Colin, a young population is something that most developed countries would deeply love to have.
One unfortunate casualty, it seems, of COVID disruption was a kind of, if I've got this right, a kind of economics festival that you have a hand in, Kilconomics.
Yes, it's an economics and stand-up comedy festival by that. It's a bizarre idea that we came up with about 10 years ago to combine comedy and economics. So the economists come from all over the world, like the Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman came last year, but only stand-up comedians are allowed to ask the questions. So the panels are actually emceed by stand-up comedians. It works really well. In actual fact, we sold 10,000 tickets last year, which somebody told me makes it the biggest economics festival in the world, which is kind of mad. It's in a place called Kilkenny. A-list economists and A-list comedians put them on stage together and just let the fireworks begin. It's great crack.
You are described, and maybe you don't like this tag, I don't know, but you've been described as a punk economist. I don't think I've ever come across one of those in New Zealand, but maybe they are and they just don't get described as such. Is this a tag you yourself rejoice in?
No, it comes from a series of cartoons I did called Punk Economics, which were a series of cartoons trying to demystify. If you think that punk was a reaction against the overblown nature of progressive rock in the mid-70s, and punk was like a sort of a DIY movement that you'd strip down your old thing. You didn't really necessarily have to play. You just had to have an attitude and a vision for what music was about. And it struck me that economics was going through its prog rock, overbearing guitar solo phases. And we put together, you can actually see them on YouTube. It's called Punk Economics. There's loads of videos up there. It was a way of teaching because I am in my day job as well, a professor, an adjunct professor in Trinity. So I teach economics for a crust. But, you know, it's always good to challenge the orthodoxy of your own profession, whether you're a broadcaster or an economist or whatever you happen to be. I think it's always quite refreshing.
I wanted to say, you know, you could have recorded a hit single, Economy, in the UK, but it doesn't work because you're Irish. Well, never mind the budgets.
No, never mind the budgets, exactly. You know, but my sense is that actually we should have a couple of New Zealand economists. If you have any good ones who can talk, send them my way. You've got me. You can get me on Twitter at @DavidMacW. And send them over. We'd love to hear from them.
Well, I'll cast the net out and see if we can get a couple across to Kilconomics when it does return. But given what you've told me about the weather, we can't promise them any holidays in the sun.
No holidays in the sun. Oh, I liked what you did there. But listen, it's great. It's great to know that you guys are listening down to podcasts down in New Zealand. That's fantastic. So next weekend, we'll give you a big shout out.
Indeed, thoroughly recommend. It's just the David McWilliams podcast, so no tricky titles, easy to find.
Cheers, Colin. Take care. Look after yourself.
Thank you. Cheers, David.